He's been called the Pope of Tibet because the Dalai Lama is the religious leader of the Tibetans. But how does the history of the Dalai Lama compare to the institution of St. Peter? Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and on the Ark this week, one of the best-known historians of Tibetan Buddhism, Robert Thurman of Columbia University, joins me from London, where he's attending the engagement party of his daughter, Uma. To understand how a Lama is chosen, you really have to appreciate the role of rebirth in Buddhist thought, and in particular, the central role of Avalokiteshvara, the celestial bodhisattva or disciple of the Buddha.
Avalokiteshvara is considered the incarnation of the universal compassion of all Buddhas, and they have a special relation to Tibet. They have some scriptures from India where he made a vow in heaven before his teacher, the Buddha, Boundless Light, Amitabha Buddha, that he would make a special effort to tame the Tibetans, as the Buddhists put it, which means civilize them, and to introduce them to the Dharma and make them happy. He chose them not because they were so great, but because actually they were very violent. They were like Genghis Khan 1,000 years earlier. They were tremendous conquerors, and they were terrorizing their neighbors in China and India and Nepal and Mongolia and so on because they were so ferocious. So he said he would make them see the light of the Dharma and become more peaceful and more happy. And therefore they feel he kind of is their kind of patron, you know, angel who protects the nation. Like St. George, isn't it? In England they have St. George. So it's Avalokiteshvara in Tibet.
Now, doesn't he have a connection to the world of primates?
Oh, yes. Well, the Buddhist enlightened beings have the ability to incarnate any way they want. And so they can be reborn as animals, even as inanimate objects, actually. They can manifest one, even a planet. A Buddhist view of the power of love and compassion to incarnate itself is so extravagant, you could say, and so imaginative. And so there is a famous incarnation of Avalokiteshvara where he incarnated as a monkey. And as a monkey, he became the progenitor of the Tibetan race. Actually, that's another myth. The Dalai Lama made a funny joke about that once years ago at Harvard, where he said he wanted to testify in the trials of creationism versus evolutionism, because he said that the Tibetans have a myth that they were descended from a god, but that god was a monkey. So he thought he could mediate. And he just loved that joke, and everybody else did too.
Indeed. Well, in actual history, as opposed to myth, who was the first important Buddhist leader for the Tibetans?
The first important Buddhist leader, you could say, would be the Emperor Songzhen Gambo, who lived in the 7th century and was considered an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. And his queens from China and Nepal, his two principal queens out of his 9 queens, were also considered emanations of his female reflex known as Tara. Sort of therefore top down on the militaristic Tibetans of the time, he began to import Buddhism and bring an ethic of peacefulness and gentleness into their culture. And therefore he's considered the first incarnation of Avalokiteshvara and the one who began to introduce Tibetans to Buddhism, created an alphabet, imported teachers and teachings, translated texts, this kind of thing.
Well, by the 13th century, Tibet is already covered in monasteries. Why do you think monastic Buddhism caught on so quickly?
Well, Buddhism has always been monastic from Buddha's own time. Buddha, having been brought up as a military man, he would have been a general had he stayed in the kingdom, the royal class, where they were the commander-in-chief in ancient India, like we see today. And so when he perceived the different view of life that made it more important to conquer your inner enemy rather than conquering any outer enemies, he organized the monastic community as a kind of army of peace, you could say, like a mirror opposite of the army of violence. So it always depended on that. And in the case of Tibet, where Buddhism came in to a very militarized society, the monastic institution was the key institution to help slowly and gradually demilitarize it, although it took, by the 13th century, then it's already going on 6 centuries or 7 centuries by then. So it wasn't that it so quickly and easily happened. There was resistance to the monasticism because those sort of warlords perceived that would erode their power. So it's always a seesaw conflict between militarism and monasticism in Asian history. Mm. And where monasticism dominates, as in the case of Tibet, militarism declines.
Yes.
And vice versa.
Well, let's talk about karma and the role it had in choosing Buddhist lamas. And the Victor Karmapa was the first. What was special about him?
Well, the only thing was special, the name Karmapa doesn't really mean that karma is choosing. Karma only means causation. So when you say karma is involved in choosing, just mean they're looking at certain types of causation. It's reincarnation that began to become a principle of leadership in Tibetan culture from around the 13th century with the first Karmapa. And that was simply a matter of a little boy was born somewhere, and then when he was old enough to talk, which was quite young, he began to tell his parents and neighbors, actually, I'm not just so-and-so. I'm a lama who used to be a teacher in such-and-such a province. Take me back to my disciples. And at first they thought he was just babbling or maybe demented. And eventually he was so insistent, they did. And then it turned out he recognized the people without having been introduced. He knew the names of the places. And he had a remarkable spiritual aptitude, as if he had cultivated some insights in previous lives. And that began to be like where then when someone would come to die who was such a great teacher, he would say, well, look for me in such and such a county, like look for me in SW10, or look for me in Liverpool. Never mind, I won't be in London next life, sort of like that. And then they would go look, and then they would find a kid, and then they would test him and he would recognize them. So you have to understand, in Buddhist culture, the idea that when we die we seek rebirth in some sort of animal form, not necessarily human. And when we are unconsciously living and dying, we don't know where we're going. When they become conscious about it, they can choose where they're going. And this to them is a common sense thing. It's like, you know, driving on the interstate highway. It's a normal thing for them. It's not a mystical thing for them. Yes. So the idea that leaders who were devoted to their people and who hadn't finished helping their people reach certain goals for the society or for the individuals would be reborn and continue to help them is sort of a very normal thing in Tibetan society, although very unique in the world. Nowhere else in the Buddhist world, although they also believe in rebirth and reincarnation, did they have the concept of a conscious reincarnation that would be then recognized and institutionalized.
Tell me about the origin of the Dalai Lama and when that name emerged in the Tibetan tradition.
Okay. Right. Well, there was a disciple of Dzongkhapa who lived in around the turn of the 15th century, whose name was Gendun Drupa, and was a great teacher and leader and considered very enlightened. After he died, a boy was found who said, I'm him. I am the Gendun Drupa, and I want to get back to my work. And eventually was recognized, but they still didn't call him Dalai Lama or anything. And then the third one, who again, I'm so-and-so, and they found him and recognized him. But by this time, there were a number of those lines in Tibet. The third one happened to be invited to a Mongolian emperor's palace or kingdom in the north of Tibet. And that Mongolian, at the time, was being very ferocious, typical emperor, conquering and fighting with people. And when he met that third Dalai Lama, he sort of changed his ways rather dramatically. He was so impressed by the meeting. And he's the one who used the word Dalai, which is a Mongolian word and means something like ocean or vast. And then from that time on, the Dalai Lamas became known as the Dalai Lama. And they looked back to the two boys before him who had said, I am the same person. So he became Dalai Lama III, although the name only was received at that time. And the first four Dalai Lamas had no political power at all. They were simply founding monasteries and teaching religion. But the fifth one, in the 17th century, was born in a time of tremendous turbulence. He practically had to be hidden in his youth because the tradition was being persecuted by warlords, where there were getting to be so many monasteries that the lay people, the lay aristocrats who were used to having all the manpower and having armies, they saw all the men becoming monks and no longer obeying their orders, and they became nervous with this, what they considered over-monasticization of the land. And so they were persecuting the Dalai Lama order, which was particularly charismatic.
Is that the Gelugpa?
Yeah, it later became known as the Gelugpa, yeah. But then what happened was the Mongolians heard that their beloved Dalai Lamas were being persecuted. So they rushed in and disarmed everybody, let's say. You know, that was only a few centuries after Genghis Khan when they conquered all of Eurasia, more or less. And then the warlords kind of listened and decided, well, okay, the Mongolians and so on. So let's be ruled by a lama and let's demilitarize. Not exactly unanimously, but anyway, it was a resolution of the Reformation thing in the favor of monasticism, sort of the mirror opposite of what happened in Europe in the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, where, you know, Northern Europe became demonasticized by the Protestant movement and therefore militarized and therefore resulted in the colonial movement that conquered the world. Whereas in the case of Tibet, they became monasticized and demilitarized, and they abandoned their empires, and they even got the Mongolians to abandon their empires in the next century or two.
Bob Thurman, is that when the Potala was built?
That's right.
In Lhasa.
That's exactly right. The fifth Dalai Lama then embarked in 1630s on the construction of the Potala, which is an amazing building because, in a way, what it represents is a fusion institution where you have a monastery, a seat of government, and a mystical mandala, as they would call it, or a platform up to receive the blessings of Avalokiteshvara, the sort of heavenly vision of life, to sort of say that the millennium is here, you know, it's the New Jerusalem is here for the Mahayana Buddhists. So education and inner enlightenment should be where the whole budget of the nation goes, not the Pentagon, not the militarism that it had gone to there, you know, previously. And it's a remarkable social achievement that it represents. Westerners call it theocracy, but it isn't really theocracy because that relates to a Western social structure and ideological structure where they believe in an omnipotent God. Yes. This, you could call it a Buddhocracy, if you like, meaning that people believe that the presence of enlightened beings is everywhere, and therefore the individual's quest for enlightenment should be at the center of their life, not a peripheral thing.
After the Potala was built, the fifth Dalai Lama died, and I gather his death wasn't revealed for a while. And then the sixth
right.
Dalai Lama came along, and he was a bit of a rogue and had it probably too hard an act to follow. But there were a couple of centuries there with a degree of stability. And that all ended around the turn of the 20th century. What happened to the 13th Dalai Lama then?
The 13th Dalai Lama luckily lived to his majority. In the 19th century was a bad time for Tibet, and the Dalai Lamas did not reach their majority due to probably corruption around them. And the corruption also of the Manchu Empire, which the Manchurians had been supporters of the Tibetans as peacekeepers in Asia through the 18th century, which had been a flourishing century for Tibet. The 19th was a bad century, but the 13th Dalai Lama survived it at the end, and he became quite strong in Tibet, and he was renewing things very nicely. But then the British invaded Tibet in 1904, thereby established relations with the world. The 13th Dalai Lama fled, and he was the first one to be, you know, like the Russians, the Americans, the British, the French, the Chinese, and so on, and be outside of Tibet. But the Manchu Empire was in the throes of its last gasp at that time. Remember, they collapsed in 1911, and they were very irritated by this British incursion there, and so they counter-invaded. And then the Dalai Lama had to escape to India to the protection of the British, actually, and got to know them very nicely. Sir Charles Bell and Hugh Richardson and his relationship with them developed from there. So he then declared independence in 1912. And after the fall of the Manchu Empire, and he didn't allow the nationalist Chinese to have any control whatsoever in Tibet, tried to get into the League of Nations, but due to sort of international hypocrisy, you could say, in the diplomatic game, the outer powers, imperial powers, didn't think it was in their interest to introduce Tibet as the independent nation that it was, so they never got into the League of Nations. And this made for the ambiguity and the complexities in the modern period that happened during the time of the 14th Dalai Lama. Then in the 1930s, when the 13th Dalai Lama saw the Russian communists come in and destroy Tibetan Buddhism in Mongolia, he kind of freaked out and he said, "We're going to see this red tide everywhere. It's going to come to Tibet in the future. Although I could live another 15 years, I don't want to, because I don't want to be in a tiny baby when this happens to Tibet. So I'm going to pass away now in the 1930s and be reborn quickly, so I'll be at least able to help you Tibetans in the future when the communist Red Ocean flows into our shores." And he did. And then the 14th Dalai Lama, as we know, was born in 1935 and was 15 when the Chinese invaded Tibet. And although he was a little young to handle it, he's been trying to cope and integrate this experience, which has been the most terrible experience for the Tibetans in their history. He's been trying to deal with that for the last 50, 60 years.
Robert Thurman on the 14th Dalai Lama, who's believed to be the reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion.